Thank you for coming out on this cold morning. We are the first, the Parish Jazz Band of First Parish Church Unitarian Universalist, and we're going to do a little jazz service for you this morning. Thank you for coming out. We're going to start with our prelude, two numbers, Deep Purple and Out of Nowhere, a swing tune and a Latin tune. So hope you enjoy it.
Thank you.
That before our first cup of coffee. Good morning. Welcome to the First Parish Church of Stowe and Acton, a Unitarian Universalist congregation. Our minister, Tom Rossiello, Reverend Tom Rossiello, is away this week in a warm place, but will soon return to our pulpit. I'm Michael Palladini, and I've served many roles in this church, most recently helping move the Parish Jazz Band forward a little bit. So welcome, and we're very glad you're here this morning. We are going to do our chalice lighting and covenant, and I dragooned my wife, Peggy Palladini, to assist in this. So as Peggy lights our chalice, which is a little rustic this morning, please join me in reciting the words of our covenant. Love is the spirit of this church, and service its law. This is our great covenant, to dwell together in peace, to seek the truth in love, and to help one another. Thank you. I sound good. So this is part of the worship service where we have a message for all ages. I do see people of all ages out there. So particularly to the younger folks out there, how many of you, just by a show of hands, play a musical instrument? If you're a young person. Okay. Hey, there we go. Okay. Way in the back. Good. Okay, those of you that don't play a musical instrument, how many of you sing? Alright, everybody should raise their hand there. We all sing, right? Even just happy birthday at a birthday party. So if you like to sing, I'm going to do a little shameless commercial here. If you like to sing, we have two choirs oriented towards young people. We have the children's choir and the youth choir run by Pat Sorn. So see Pat about that, and it gives you an opportunity to sing with other people in church. So and this would be a great time to join either one of those groups. So when we speak, we use words, and the words are made up of letters of the alphabet, right? Everybody agree on that? So what's the alphabet of music? Can anybody tell me? What's the alphabet of music? Yes? Anybody? Just call it out. In the back? Yeah, okay. It also uses our alphabet, but I'm thinking of what, when I go, la, 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 what am I singing? Notes. Did somebody say notes? Notes. Notes are the, notes are the alphabet. What? Yeah, right, right. Those are, actually, we're gonna talk about that in just a second. Right, notes. Notes are the alphabet of music.
It's called a scale.
It's called a scale, right. And the important, there are lots of notes in music, but one set of important notes is a scale. It's called a major scale. And somebody was saying it before. It goes do, re, mi, fa, sol, la, ti, do. It's eight notes, right? Do, do, re, mi, fa, sol, la, ti, do. Most people don't know it, but that do, re, mi, fa has a name. Actually, it's called something in music. It's called, it's a French word, okay? It's called solfège. Solfège. The do, re, mi is a solfège in Italian, like in Italian, too. It's solfeggio in Italian. So that's a do, re, mi scale. And there is a song that we're going to sing as a group that comes from a movie that many of you may have seen, appropriately called The Sound of Music. Okay? And we see that movie, right? Julie Andrews, you know, Swiss Alps, Nazis, all that. So great, great movie, though. Beautiful music. And we're going to sing the Do Re Mi song from that and then send you off to religious education. We're going to hear about, I think, from Bob Tabor about the work that this church through Bob and others does in India. So that'll be very, very interesting to listen to. So let me get my guitar and come down front here, and we're going to sing the Do Re Mi song, okay?
Thank you. story. Thank you. And Trisha will play, I think, another tune, not this one, as you head out to our
thank you.
So I'm going to speak this morning on harmony and dissonance, a little bit of music theory and music history, called Harmony and Dissonance, the message of music and its meaning for us. And I'm taking as my text the words from Claude Debussy that you'll see printed at the top of the order of service inside. The dissonance of today is the consonance of tomorrow at the top there. Even after playing music for 40 years, I still marvel at a major seventh chord. A major seventh is made up of the first, third, fifth, and seventh notes of a major scale. So taking that do, re, mi scale that we sang with the children when they were here, do, re, mi, fa, sol, la, ti, do, we take the do, mi, so, and ti and put them together like this. Do, mi, so, ti, do, mi, so, ti. It's a beautiful chord. Indeed, it's one of the most beautiful in music. But what's odd is that it works only if the notes are in that order. Because remember, the T is the seventh note, which is followed by the eighth, which is the do. And the eighth is the same as the first, only an octave higher. If we put the T and the do right next to each other, it's kind of ugly. Let me demonstrate. The tension, the conflict, the dissonance becomes a little bit unbearable and unpleasant to the ear. So what's the problem? It's a very obedient guitar. What's the problem there? Oddly, the notes are too close. In musical terms, they're only a half step apart. The notes can live peaceably together. Indeed, can even contribute to the beauty of the whole only if they are suitably separated, because they're inherently too close. One might say, too much alike to get along. I'm reminded of so much of our world for which this seems to be a metaphor. The Jews and the Arabs, who are in fact ethnically very close. Within Islam, Sunni and Shia, only a small half step apart on the issue of the line of succession from the Prophet Muhammad, Cain and Abel, and all the other sibling rivalries down through the ages. Straight people and gays, who after all are both expressing their God-given sexuality, but with only a small difference in gender preference. So the dissonance of today is becoming the consonance of tomorrow, even as we see change in attitudes towards gays and lesbians. Even those of you who are parents know that it's the child that is most like you that you can't seem to get along with. We see our own flaws and limitations writ large and carried forward into the future by the son or daughter whose personality is only a small half step away from our own. But if we keep our distance, it works, and we can have a beautiful chord under one sky or under one roof. The Chinese character for happiness is a combination of the characters for harmony and home. Happiness is harmony in our home. The word harmony comes from the Greek, meaning agreement or concord, from the verb harmozo, literally to fit together or join. How the chord is joined together becomes very important. Music teaches us how to blend dissonance into harmony. In music's melody and chords, we are presented with a model of apt distance and presence that's difficult to achieve in our daily lives. There are many lessons for us in musical intervals, and not only the major seventh interval. But to appreciate them, we need to understand a little history, with the caveat that I'm going to limit myself to Western music, which unfortunately is the only kind of music I can appreciate or understand. Major seventh chords weren't always allowed. Indeed, for a long time, during the so-called Middle Ages, all that was allowed was something called monotic plain chant. Basically, just a melody without any accompanying harmony. If you think about the music we're playing today, you get a sense of how far music has come from the Middle Ages. And the institution forbidding certain types of music was, surprise, the Roman Catholic Church, which dominated all aspects of life in ways that possibly we can't even imagine today. Gradually, the church came to allow parallel perfect intervals as a harmonic addition, deciding that the pleasure of some harmony was perhaps not too sinful. As the pianist Zalman Rosenfeld writes, the church would go back and forth on the permissibility of music. In 1322, Pope John XII banned polyphony from the Mass. But in 1364, that would be about, 42 years later, it returned under Pope Urban V. Later in the 16th century, the Council of Trent called for a return to simplicity and even discussed mandating Gregorian chant as the only permissible music. The church feared the ways in which music can stir the emotions. The church was afraid of music's power. In my view, music is so powerful that it is indeed the queen of all the arts, the perfect blend of form and content. Feelings seek articulation in thought. Thoughts are expressed in words. Words at their best long to be poetry. Poetry aspires to be music, and music speaks to the inarticulate heart of our feelings. Consider once more our do, re, mi. Flat the third, the mi, and everything changes. So we go do, re, mi, that's major. Do, re, mi, alright, that's minor. We move from major to minor, which we hear in an entirely different way. Again, we're talking about a difference of only half a step. Yet it opens up and reflects the entire world. Yin and yang, darkness and light, sorrow and joy. As the poet William Blake once wrote, sorrow and joy are woven fine, and never so fine as in music, which moves seamlessly between major and minor keys, or between major and minor chords in the same key, and weaves beauty in the process. To quote Ann Porter from her lovely poem Music, why is it that music, at its most beautiful, opens a wound in us, an ache, a desolation, deep as a homesickness for some far-off and half-forgotten country? What to do with such power? The Catholic Church eventually decided to co-opt it, to enlist that power on behalf of the worship of God. Back to my authoritative friend, Zalman Rosenfeld, who wrote, once the Church realized that the more glorious the liturgical music, the more powerful the message, it began to sponsor music that expressed varietas, that is, surprise and delight. By the late 17th century, the musical ground was firm enough to bear the giant footsteps of Johann Sebastian Bach. Employing all the devices of his predecessors, including polyphony, dance rhythms, dramatic recitative, and simple hymns, Bach fashioned music that is the quintessence of varietas. He also summoned up the most brilliant and beautiful sounds ever heard before. As the contemporary composer Michael Torka has said, why waste money on psychotherapy when you can listen to Bach's Mass in B minor? Bach died in 1750. Mozart lived from 1756 to 1791. Beethoven from 1770 to 1827. Each one of these men pushed the boundaries of what was possible in music at the time. For example, Beethoven's late quartets, now considered one of the signal accomplishments of Western music, were not well received in his lifetime. One contemporary musician said, we know there's something there, but we do not know what it is. While another contemporary composer derided them as, quote, indecipherable, uncorrected horrors, close quote. Yet later, upon hearing Beethoven's own personal favorite among the quartets, the 14th, Opus 131, in C-sharp minor, Schubert is said to have remarked, after this, what is left for us to write? The dissonance of today is the consonance of tomorrow. I'll return to Beethoven in a little bit. As we get closer to modern times, the pace of musical change accelerates. Think about this. From Beethoven's death in 1827 to the birth near Texarkana, Texas in 1867 or 1868, we're not sure, of one Scott Joplin, son of a slave, was only 40 short years or so. Not that Joplin and Beethoven are on an equal plane, but it was Joplin who opened up the possibility of what we here in the Paris Jazz Band are playing today. With ragtime, we had the dominant seventh to the family, indeed featured in ways that it had never been featured before. The dominant seventh is the seventh note of the major scale, our old friend T, flat, that is lower a half step. Let's listen for the sevenths in Joplin. Trish, if you'd play a little bit of like the first eight bars of the Antipater. Transitions to new musical forms were not always easy. Scott Joplin died in 1917. On May 29th, 1913, 4 years earlier, at the Théâtre des Champs-Élysées in Paris, the debut of Stravinsky's ballet, The Rite of Spring, practically caused a riot in the theater. This is what the church feared, the capacity of music to stir up passionate and even dangerous emotions. And yet today I think we all listen to Stravinsky with great pleasure. With time, dissonance once again has yielded to consonance. Joplin's ragtime is perhaps one of the earliest forms of jazz. With time, jazz grew and changed, borrowing from and integrating another African-American musical form, the blues. Then the great black saxophonist Charlie Parker, also known as the Bird, in the short 35 years of his life from 1920 to 1955, revolutionized jazz with a style called bebop. With bebop came extensive use of the flatted fifth, at the time a very dissonant note in a major chord. Berendt in the jazz book called the flatted fifth, quote, the most important interval of bebop. Yet how quickly we listeners were learning. By 1957, only 2 years after Parker's death, the flatted fifth had gone mainstream, with the original Leonard Bernstein, Stephen Sondheim Broadway production of West Side Story. The lovely, incomparable song Maria relies on, indeed leans on the flatted fifth for its poignancy and power. So the opening of that song, you know the whole song Maria, right? It goes, Maria, right? Maria, that re. That's a flat five. The jump is from, instead of just going right to the fifth, he goes, Maria, I just met a girl named Maria. By the way, personal note, when I was, that came out in 1957. In the early 1960s, when I was 7 or 8 years old, I listened to the West Side Story album hundreds upon hundreds of times. I cut my teeth on that album, so that was my first, that was what said to me, oh wow, music. So, back to bebop. Bebop also explored other new harmonic ideas, including a tonal vocabulary using ninths, elevenths, and thirteenths of chords. These are the so-called extended intervals. What are these? These are the notes above the second do of the do-re-mi scale. So the ninth is the next re, the eleventh is the next fa, and so on. So you put the fourth on top and you make it the 11th, and it's a really neat sound, or at least has become one once the Bird and his peers taught our ears to love it. All of this, you gotta understand, all of this was nearly, was actually unthinkable nearly 200 short years ago. Indeed, I often wonder, what would the revolutionary Mozart think listening to music nowadays? Particularly Lady Gaga. Would he run from the room holding his hands over his ears? Certainly we can be sure that the Council of Trent would say that we are playing here today the devil's music. My real topic is context. Music in the context of its culture, notes in the context of their chords, people in the context of their society, history, and family. I marvel at music's ability to recontextualize and wish we shared that ability in our own lives. If we did, we would live in a more peaceful and harmonious world. Let me finish with two examples of the recontextualization of a single note. My first example is from a gentleman that's been called the Ellington of Latin America, Antonio Carlos Jobim, who in his delightful one-note samba manages to open his melody with 30 repetitions of an F note. And it goes like this. Trish is going to play it for us. So the F undergoes being the flatted third of a minor seventh chord. Play just the first major. So go back to the beginning. It's a flatted third of a minor seventh chord, the third of a major chord in the next major, the fourth of another minor seventh chord, and finally our old jazz friend, the flatted fifth. The chord descends around that resilient F note while it stubbornly stays put like a fundamental principle in a changing world. I might add that in the next eight bars, the words are really cute. The next eight bars go, now this new note is the consequence of the one we've just been through. As I'm bound to be the unavoidable consequence of you. Pretty cute song. If you think this recontextualization game is only some modern jazz pastime, I submit what I think is the most powerful example of all. We return to Beethoven as promised. In the slow movement of his Seventh Symphony, probably one of my favorite musical compositions of all time, he famously begins his melody with 12 straight E notes. That note. He goes da-da-da-da, 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 12 times. You probably recognize both the melody and one of Beethoven's favorite rhythmic figures as well, the da-da-da-da. Beethoven loved da-da-da-da, as in da-da-da-da, da-da-da-da. That's the Fifth Symphony. And while my singing can't do any of the symphonies justice, I'm sure many of you will recognize those 12 E's from the Seventh and recall their magnificence. What's going on? For each cluster of four notes, we move through an A minor chord with an A bass note. Let me play this for you. It's really kind of cool. So, stay. It goes like this. Right? So he goes da 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 da. So just like that. So just two chords, 12 notes. Okay. It goes from an A minor chord to an E major chord with a B bass note, and back to an A minor chord with a C bass note. As the melody continues, da 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 da. This A minor, E major, A minor sequence is literally as easy as A B C. The bass line goes. During that. This is the utter simplicity beyond all complexity that only genius can achieve. But here's the thing. While I can explain to you musically what's going on here, I don't even come close to explaining its depth or power. As Beethoven himself exclaimed in a heartfelt letter written in 1812, "Ah, there are moments when I feel that speech amounts to nothing at all." As the philosopher of music, Victor Zuckerman, wrote, and this is a quote on the back of your order of service, "Hearing a melody is hearing, having heard, and about to hear all at once. Every melody declares to us that the past can be there without being remembered, the future without being foreknown." Scientists in 2009 unearthed the flute carved from the bone of a bird some 35,000 years ago. This treasure is shown on the front of your order of service. One imagines the flute was made from the bone of a bird because our primitive ancestors believed in magic. Song, of course, would be in the bird, and to fashion a piece of the bird into a musical instrument would be to have the bird's power. One archaeologist said, music lies close to the foundation of our common humanity. And since this five-holed flute was dug up, it's been reported that another archaeologist built a replica and is learning to play. The first thing he tried, limited by the number of notes available to him on the world's oldest flute, was the Star Spangled Banner. And the reason, I'm sure I know why he did the Star Spangled Banner, after, after that cuts deep, say, can you see, is a major chord. It's the first, the third, the fifth, and the eighth. So he was limited, I think, by the limitations of the instrument. The Star Spangled Banner, no flat fifths or sharp ninths in that tune. 35,000 years ago, Homo sapiens couldn't conceive of a Charlie Parker. I'm so glad the bird is in our family now. I look forward to new notes and the new harmony to come. Thank you for listening. So let's sing. We're gonna do Come Sunday, and then we're gonna sing hymn number 360, and then we'll wrap up. Thank you. you. Please be seated. Okay, Patricia has it. All right, what's our opening? Please join me in singing this. Peace be.